liberty and justice for all.
Okay, roll call. All the council members are here. Citizen input is the next item on our agenda. So if you'd like to address the council on an issue of the city that's council business, you can by raising your hand. I'll acknowledge you, and I'll give you 5 minutes up here at the microphone here to address this. Give us your name and phone number when you get up there. So is there anybody who'd like to address the council? Just raise your hand. Okay. Do I hear an approval of the agenda by somebody? Motion?
I so move.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
And the same for opposed? Okay. Okay. Consent agenda. Do I hear a motion on the consent agenda?
So move.
Okay. Dan?
I'll second.
Okay. John? Any discussion on the consent agenda? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And the same, if you oppose. Okay, thank you. Okay, Saddle Mountain Wind Farm. Ken Kaler, you want to introduce our guest?
Okay.
Kaler, right. Got two Kens here.
Yeah, I'd like to introduce Elon Hassan. He's the project manager for the Western Division of Horizon Wind Energy. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the Saddle Mountain Wind Farm up on Saddle Mountain. Before he gets started, I want to correct one item in our paperwork here. I told you there was 43 windmills. I think the number is 32, unless we can convince him we need another 11. So, anyway, it's all up to you.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Mayor Wilson. I was going to run through the council today, the Saddle Mountain West project, and start with a little bit about Horizon Wind Energy, what the project will look like, and a little bit about wind development, how we think about how to build a farm, what goes into it, then go through the details of Saddle Mountain project and talk about some of the things that will occur here and we hope to occur here in Othello. So first, Horizon Wind Energy. We are the third largest developer of wind energy in the world. What you see in front of you on the screen here are operating projects. We actually started as a small family company called Zilka Renewable Energy in 1998-99. And with Zilka, we developed the Wild Horse project in Ellensburg, which some of you may be familiar with. Zilka was then sold and bought and sold to our current owner, which is we're now part of EDPR. And under EDPR, we're owner-operators of our wind farms, which means we hold the wind farm for the life of the project. So we're not going to sell it to anybody. So we intend to be here and be neighbors with in all our wind farms, as you can see there across the country. We've got three in Oregon, two in Gillum County, the Wheatfield Wind Farm and the Rattlesnake Road Wind Farm. And down in Union County, there's the Elkhorn Wind Farm. We're working on the Kittitas Valley Wind Farm in Washington here in Kittitas County, and Saddle Mountain here in Adams County. Horizon, there we go, okay. So why wind energy? So, the Zilkas who started us, they were actually an old oil family who developed some technology in oil, and we're looking for the next stage of development, and really we're able to see the potential growth that was going to occur here in the United States. I think Europe has about 15% of its energy coming from wind, and the U.S. now is, I think it's over the 1% hurdle, but when we started it was below 1%. So we're really seeing a tremendous growth now in wind energy, and the benefits have been noticed throughout. I mean, I think first and foremost, as I think we've all seen, wind energy is local energy. It's homegrown in the U.S., and it'll always be produced here. We don't have to bring it in from anywhere else. The thing that I really have come to enjoy about wind energy is its compatibility with agriculture and the rural community. I mean, there's not much that you can do. When you've got a farm and you're using the land and you're trying to use every inch of the land, not much can really add value to it. But we work really well with farmers and ranchers. with turbines, it can be an added source of income and really helps him improve the agricultural business model. Okay, so Saddle Mountain Wind Farm. So if you look, there's a sort of snapshot of the state of Washington. There's a little outline of the project boundary. That's the land we have under lease. It's not all going to be a wind farm. And the project, you know, it's on Saddle Mountain. We expect to come down Highway 24, then go down Bench Road, either continue down Bench Road over onto Coon, or take a left over there on O'Brien, and enter the project at the end of Coon Road. There's a irrigation canal that sort of peters out towards the end there. It's just piped over there at the end, so it'll be minimum impact. We would do any of that crossing over there at the end. That would happen in the growing season, so there wouldn't be any impact to the irrigation system out there. So the road construction. So the first thing you'd see, I think, is improvements to the roads. They've got to be clear, graded, and gravel. They're typically 16 to 34 feet. Bench roads in great shape and probably wouldn't need any improvements. I think O'Brien is won't need a whole lot, and Coon will have a little bit of improvement on it, I would imagine. The need for the improvements is there are nine parts to the turbines. They come in nine pieces, and the heaviest one is the nacelle, which weighs about 30 tons. The roads need to be standards to move that. We'll be going through working with the county engineer and getting road permits for any road we develop. So the first thing is grading, evening them out, and then drainage, installing culverts. See a good picture of a culvert there. Obviously, this looks like the Midwest, one of our Midwest projects. Anytime we cross a canal, what we actually do when we actually build the roads, we'll drive down there with a video camera, and then when we're done with the road, we're going to make sure it looks just like it did when we originally drove down with a video camera, to make sure there's no added impacts. So, what does a wind farm look like? It's got turbines, roads, a lay-down yard, bring all the stuff in and lay it down and then move it out throughout the project area. Met towers are meteorological towers. They're up there now. You can see them on the Saddle Mountain. They measure the wind. A substation, and that's what gets the power on the line. That has transformers, capacitors, and step-ups. And O&M, or the operations and maintenance building. Now five of those will definitely be up on Saddle Mountain. The O&M building, that can be in the town of Othello, that could be just off-site. It's got to be somewhere where people can get to the project reasonably quickly, but it doesn't actually have to be there itself. What you're looking at there on the map, what's really nice about this project is it's fairly simple. There's a single ridge line, and where you put the towers is an art. This is not the final layout. This is not what it's going to necessarily look like. We're constantly measuring the wind because every nook and cranny of that terrain has a little bit different wind. And once we put them in the ground, they're stuck. That's where they're going. So we'll keep refining this layout to maximize the total possible energy use of the wind resource. The little triangles you see on the map there, those are current Met towers that are on the ground now, spinning around, measuring the wind. The blue line is a potential road, the little circles with the X's in them, those are the turbines. And the red road in the northwest corner, that would be the one access road. So this project, we try and design our projects at minimum impact. The land is currently being used mostly for ranching. There's a few orchards around there as well. And we would expect all the folks to be able to continue to farm it, ranch it, and do whatever they want with the land. I feel like I was going to tell you one other thing. So, and there are 32 turbine sites there. Ken, we'll do our best to get 10 more in there. One interesting thing about setting these down, the reason you can't just put more in there is they'll wake each other. You can't have, you know, if the wind's coming from one direction, you can't have two turbines parallel with each other because they'll wake each other out. The first turbine will suck the wind out of the second turbine. So that's part of the idea on these layouts, because the turbines will yaw. They will turn automatically to face the wind. So the wind's blowing southwest one day, which I think is the predominant direction here, and one day it's blowing northeast. The turbines will totally shift and to capture that wind. But they can't, but once they, if they're, you can see, if you can imagine, if the wind's blowing that direction, you're going to have a lot of wake outs. So try not to have that happen. And the blades also will turn, they'll feather out if the wind gets too high so as not to damage the turbine. So the roads. So there's generally a driveway to the wind turbine. All the roads are between 16 and 34 feet. The 34 feet are, it's for the, everything is designed around the crane that erects the tower. So that's the 34 feet. That's why we need that. During operations, we only need about 16 feet. And so usually, sometimes we can reclaim the remaining people who can do math feet on that 18 feet. But if you ever need to get the crane back up there, you have to take it out again. It's graveled. It's built to heavy, built to handle the heavy component transport equipment, and again that nacelle, which weighs about 30 tons. The other reason the area is, well, part of the area accounts for the turning radius. The trucks coming in, for example, they're about 150 feet long, so when they swing out, we need to have enough area to cover the entire turn. So then, how these things get built. So first thing is we dig a foundation and pour concrete down underneath it. We'll, before we go out there, we'll be doing geotech testing to see what the soil is like in the area, to see how easy that's going to be. We don't anticipate any problems here. Then it's anchored down with rebar. That's a spread foot stand. Foundation, and so that's about 55 to 60 feet across and about 4 feet deep is that wide area, and then that'll all be filled in up to the stem, which is about 8 or 9 feet deep of concrete and about 20 feet in diameter, and that's where the turbines we put right on top. So the idea is that we don't want these to move much because it's really high wind. Pour the concrete, and that's what it'll look like before the tower goes on it, right there in the bottom corner. So in terms of impacts on the ground, you've got, starting from the bottom there, you've got the underground cable. So that's what's gonna, all the energy from the tower is basically gonna feed into that transformer written XFRM. And that goes down into the underground cable, which runs it back to the substation on one end of the mountain. There's a road about 34 feet, the crane pad area, so the crane can set up and lift the tower pieces. And the tower. The overall footprint of a project is between 1% and 3% of the whole area that we call the wind project. So this area, I think, is 4,340 feet. So, you know, back of a napkin, 43 to 80 feet of, 43 to 80 acres of permanent impact to the ground. Towers arrive in 3 to 4 sections, depending on how tall the towers are. These will probably be 3. They come into the Port of Vancouver. They come into the Port of Houston. I know some trains can carry them, but they'll probably be trucked in from one of those areas. I know there's different companies have different manufacturing areas for different parts of the turbine. So there's the 3 tower sections, which is what you're looking at here. Now Vestas, for example, they've got a tower manufacturing plant in Colorado. The blades are often made where the blades and the nacelle are often made where the company is based, mainly because that's the most delicate technology. For Vestas, those are made in Denmark, or Suzlon, they're made in India. And GE, I'm not sure where they're made, but they're obviously made in the United States. I'm not sure what kind of turbines we're using yet. So the sections are just hoisted up and laid upon that stem, and they're just stacked one on top of the other. There's a whole series of bolts on the inside of the turbine. They're all fastened in to a specific degree, and they're checked, I think, at least once a month for any kind of torque or any kind of problems. The nacelle, that's the generator. That is the heaviest part, and then the blades, that is probably the longest part. The blades we're looking at here are, each one is about 50 meters long, about 150 feet. And they will be, that'll be assembled on the ground and it'll be lifted as an entire piece up on, with the nose cone up onto the nacelle. Oh, and there it is. So as you can see, it's being raised as one piece and put on there. So what does it look like? So these things are about, you know, with the tip all the way at the top, it's about 427 feet. The tower sections raised about 164 feet. You know, we're seeing, what's interesting is the turbine technology is really changing. Wind in wind energy, is renewable energy is changing all the time. Wind energy is really changing all the time. They're developing more efficient generators to capture different wind resources, and different size towers capture different wind. So just, you know, quick example, if you were on the coast, you might be able to have a big monster machine that was able to handle 100 mile an hour gusts, which these can, but those big machines, they're not going to turn when the wind's going 8 to 10 miles an hour. So the machines that, you know, what we do is we're large enough that we can match the right turbine to the right wind resource to get the maximum amount of energy produced. Okay, the electrical configuration. Reporter needs to stop taking notes because I don't understand this fully. So the wind energy, the turbines produce 34 kV AC power, which gets fed into a step-up transformer, which is somewhere in the middle there. In this case, the power lines that Avista has are 115 kilovolts, so we've got to step it up. So like if you have a, like your, for your laptops here, they've got a little transformer there, it gets nice and hot because they're reducing the voltage, or increasing the voltage. That's what's happening over there. Once we step it up to 115, this all happens at the substation. Then it goes right on the line and it goes out into the universe. The bigger the step up, the bigger, the more expensive it is. So what's, again, what's, this project is really nice in so many different levels. It's a very simple project, but it all just fits kind of nice. So there's a 115 kilovolt line and a 230 kilovolt line transecting the project. The 230 is a bigger step up, so it's more expensive. You need a bigger project to handle that kind of cost. But this one, 115 is just about right. Also, we don't need to build any more transmission lines to get to the to get to the 115 because it's right there in the project area. There's a project in Utah, for example, that's building an 80-mile feeder line to get to the transmission line, which is far and very expensive. And by the way, unheard of 3 years ago. So when I talk about things changing the wind industry, they used to say about 12 miles is all you could handle. And now they're building 80-mile lines. So each turbine has a little transformer, which is outside. It might be inside on the newer. It's that little device there in the bottom. It may not even be here, depending on the kind of turbines we're able to get. And then there's a trench, which gets totally reclaimed. And you know, wheat farmers farm on top of it, ranchers ranch on top of it. It completely disappears. And all those run directly to the substation. Interestingly, you know, we have to test the soil first to see what the thermal resistivity is of the soil, because these things get hot, and if the ground can't handle it, then we have to put overhead lines in. Haven't done that yet on Saddle Mountain, but it's kind of rare. We expect that the soil will be fine. Ah, that's right. The other major component of this is the fiber optic communications. Everyone's talking to each other from, you know, this turbine to Avista's substation to the grid. Everybody knows what's happening on each different turbine. The technology is wonderful, and a big part of these fiber optics, we need to be in constant communication to see if, you know, not only is it working, is it producing too much power? If there's a problem, you need to, you know, you can shut it off. But the other major form of input into a wind farm are these fiber optic lines. And there's cable splicing. People working. So down there on the bottom is, it looks what's a completed substation looks like. You got the wind gen, you got the wind farms in the background, and then it's just jumping on to the main transformation, to the main grid, which, you know, for, you know, so these lines run at 115, and then by the time they come into our homes, they hit the substation, they're stepped down and then go through our power lines. So this is a step before they hit our power. So that's sort of the 411 on a wind farm, using Saddle Mountain as an example. I always like to say, just for development, there's so many moving pieces, we just kind of break it down to five things. When we're looking for a wind farm, the first thing we look for is a good wind resource. It's the one thing we can't mitigate for at all. There's no negotiating we can do without a good wind resource. So that's really important. Then we look for willing landowners. This community's been great. You know, folks who are supportive of it, that's the second thing. Third thing is transmission. Is there transmission nearby? Is it congested? Is it possible to move it along the system? Then we look for permitting. Again, Washington is a very predictable permitting environment, which is, you know, all you can ask for. You know what you're supposed to do. The SEPA checklist, which I'll go through in a second, the State Environmental Policy Act, provides a nice, clean instruction manual. Go do this. It'll tell you an answer, and from there we can move on to the next decision. So it's very clean. Fifth, you need an off-taker. You need a buyer for the power. And so those are, just so everyone knows, like in development, that's how we think about building a wind farm, what we need to do. And Saddle Mountain works in many of those ways. So SEPA. So we studied this, I think there are like 19 different dimensions to SEPA. We studied everything you can possibly imagine about it. So noise, visual, wildlife, birds, bats, bunnies, bugs, you name it, we looked for it. What we did was we do a macro desktop study. So we'll just look at any map we can possibly find in the area. You know, has anybody seen anything in there we care about? And then we go, it's not really well highlighted, but then we do micro-siting. So that sort of gold fat line there, that's a 1,000-foot corridor across the mountain where we ground truth everything. So we've put botanists, wildlife biologists, archaeologists, hydrologists out, and they walk that entire area and look for anything that can possibly be there so we know what we're getting into. We also test, as I mentioned, we also do visual simulations for, you know, what's the project going to look like? Is it going to immediately affect any neighbors, any other residences? Is there any noise issues, air quality and whatnot? Now, the most striking thing that, you know, you can't walk into a fellow without noticing is the sandhill crane. And our research showed that the sandhill cranes are in the area, and they definitely are, you know, using Saddle Mountain. But we've noticed that cranes have a strong ability to, they seem to avoid things they see. So we were fairly confident that there's not going to be a large impact here with the sandhill crane. Or specifically, we don't think there's going to be a significant impact. Having said that, it's an important area, and there are cranes around. And again, the state of Washington has a sandhill crane recovery plan for how to bring the bird back. And there's the lesser sandhill crane, the greater sandhill crane, and I believe the lesser is the one that has fewer breeding pairs in Washington than the greater. I believe the majority of birds that use this area are greater sandhill cranes. Nevertheless, what we did was we read through the recovery plan and came up with a conservation plan that would complement that. So first of all, you know, noting we avoided any areas that are prime wetlands habitats for the sandhill crane, so it wouldn't interfere with any of their breeding and whatnot. We also are contributing to educational efforts in touch with the fellow with the Sandhill Crane Festival to, you know, help out any way we can there in increasing the community awareness of the sandhill crane. We do monitoring both, you know, before, and we'll do monitoring after. So we'll be able to check patterns. Obviously, if there's any fatalities, we'll be right on top of that. And we'll share all that data with Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. To the extent there are any above-ground transmission lines, we'll put bird diverters on them. Again, the cranes seem to avoid things they can see. So putting those, you know, large balls in the transmission lines gives them a disincentive from running into them. We also have to work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who are trying to acquire some more wetlands areas for future breeding grounds, which we'd like to help them with. I should say, you know, going back, Horizon really views itself as an environmental company, and we take our environmental mitigation very seriously. For all the land that we're impacting, it's shrub steppe habitat, and we will participate in a mitigation program. This is actually per the Washington Wildlife Guidelines, where we'll find 2 acres for every 1 acre we impact a shrub steppe habitat, hopefully in a place that is, you know, they're already trying to build it. We can get some more land under conservation. That's all willing landowner, willing sell, you know, willing buyer, willing seller stuff. But we were able to create, I know, at Wild Horse, a large, by swapping land around, a large pathway for large game to move through, by getting a few landowners together to make the right deals. So that's the that's pretty much the SEPA process. And then I think this is the final slide. So what happens during so the life of a wind project? So when the wind project gets built, it takes between six months of intensive building. Here we'll probably do a little bit longer because we want to get those roads going in the winter during the non-irrigation season. But once their workers come, these things go up in about 6 months. Probably be about 120 folks here to build a wind farm. And during that time, you know, food, you guys are hungry. And it's everything from things you'd expect, gravel, rock supply, crushing, cement, water. But it's also people running to the you know, tire shop because they need new tires, the hardware store because they're running out of tools. You know, fencing for whatever reasons, it's just sort of a lot of people, everything a lot of people would need in a short amount of time. Once the project's up and running, we expect it'll be staffed by between 6 and 8 folks. Again, that building will either be over there on site, it could be in town, it kind of just depends what makes sense. That'll be up to the operations guys to decide. And again, they use you know, snow removal up on the mountain is always going to be key. Road maintenance, landscaping, people like myself coming into town all the time, hotel accommodations, utilities, meals, kitchen supplies, waste disposal. All these things are things we've seen in other areas that have become in higher demand with the wind farm. We met with the emergency management folks at the last meeting, and that was really productive just to figure out kind of what the responsibilities would be if they need to learn how to climb a tower or whatnot, and we were able to and make sure that the roads would all be passable in any given season. So that's kind of what we're thinking. The Adams County approved the permit on January 28th, so now we're really doing some more work on the roads. We'll apply for a county road permit, make sure everyone's on the same page in terms of what the county road standards are. And then we'll wait and see. All goes well, we would hope to build it in 2011. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Council, any questions? Mark?
Well, I always have a ton of questions. the concrete, about how many yards per tower?
I can't just tell you it's 60 feet wide and 4 feet deep, huh?
Did you bring in your own batch plant, or did you buy it locally?
I assume we'd buy it locally. We'd, yeah.
Will I be able to see these from Othello?
Short answer is yeah. I mean, if you can see Saddle Mountain, you'll see them. There's in the county, and of course, I don't have it here, but we did a visual simulation. We took about 6 key viewing points from around the county, place where people would go, place where people would drive. Downtown Fell is one of them. You know, they're off-white, and they're off-white because that's what the FAA wants. And other than wind, the FAA is the only other thing that we cannot budge on. I don't know if this is really true. Department of Defense basically said, you know, here's where we're going to fly our planes, and Saddle Mountain is not one of those paths. And said, well, you know, do you think we could put a tower in the way of one of your bombing routes? And they said, sure, our guys love target practice. So they're real amenable to that. So they're off-white, so they're visible from the sky. So, you know, on a bright blue day, they're going to stand out more. On a cloudy day, they're going to stand out less. At about, I'd say it's about, 5 miles from Othello. Sorry, I don't have the pictures here. But you'll see them, but they're not going to be. It's kind of hard to say. I can get you pictures, though, if you want.
I was curious.
Yeah.
What we've had some pretty good fires up on Saddle Mountain. You guys got a fire plan or a distance around them, or how do you manage that?
Well, I mean, the thing is there's usually someone up there and around it. So when fires start, we usually catch them early. The road acts as pretty much as a natural fire break. Machines are kind of expensive, so I imagine we'll pretty much freak out and get the water out there. In a very responsible way, actually.
And keeping it local, even in Washington State, I believe there's some kind of manufacturing up the road in Euphrata for these. Are you guys utilizing that at all?
I really need to do my diligence on that. I know that there is a manufacturer up somewhere. I don't know who they're making the tower bases for. Mm. So we'll buy it from a turbine manufacturer. There's about five or six. And they call all the shots. I wasn't kidding, the machines are really expensive, and one of the things that they'll do is they'll review the site and figure out whether or not they can put their machines there because they warranty the machines. And Saddle Mountain doesn't have this problem, but there's, sometimes you get a great wind resource and it's on top of a cliff or like a rim or something. Well, when the wind hits that rim and just shoots up, it creates all kinds of turbulence, and that can make the tower do all kinds of funny things. And the tower companies won't sell them to you. They're just like, you can't put it there. So Saddle doesn't have that. But the turbine manufacturer has a lot of ownership over their turbines after they sell them to us. So they control where they're manufactured.
What's the maximum wind velocity for these towers, or the wind they can handle?
I'm not sure which towers we're going to use. My guess is these towers can probably deal with winds, over 80 miles an hour. They feather out. They're not producing energy at 80. I mean, they probably kick off, I'm guessing, they probably kick off energy at 40 or something. But after a while, it's just too hot.
Okay.
So they'll flare the blades out and just the wind will shoot over them. I'm guessing 80, maybe it's 100, but it's a concern in the Midwest where there are tornadoes and stuff.
Okay, I'll allow a couple people from the audience, if you want to raise your hands and have a question, you can do that. We'll acknowledge you. Okay, thanks, Elon.
Thank you. And my contact's there if anybody has any questions or comments.
Great. Thanks. Very interesting. Thank you. Okay, Juvenile Department Report. Dave Gowan. Go ahead.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. Thanks for allowing the juvenile court to come in here today. I guess to start with, I just want to say thanks for the time. I know you're busy and you have a lot going on, so appreciate the few minutes we have with you tonight. To start with, I just want to say we are not asking for money. We don't have any complaints here tonight, and we're not at this point trying to create more work for you as well. So anyway, so you can relax. We're here just to give some information. We've been talking about it for some time, and it just seemed to be the right time to come in and kind of give you an update on juvenile court. It's a county function, but we do a lot of our work within the city. And I guess to start with, just want to thank you for some of the work that you've done in the parks, especially because it really impacts, I think, the community and the families. The playground sets mean a lot. The tennis courts are great. The new set of basketball courts, I was able to oversee the Sunfair basketball this last year, as I've done for years past, and the extra set of basketball courts are put to great use. So again, thanks for doing some of those things. Maybe you wonder if it really makes a difference or not, but it really does. So Eamon and the council, thanks for doing all that on those things. It matters. It matters. I have some of my staff here today, so at any point, if you have questions for myself or the staff, I'd sure love to have you give those questions. But Jesus Valdovinos here, he is our intensive probation officer, so he handles our probably our roughest caseload. And so anyways, that's his task on a daily basis. And his job, as well as everybody's jobs, are not an 8-to-5 job. It's at night when the chief's officers give us a call, or the county deputies give us a call, and we help out with situations, you know, whenever, at nights, weekends, whatever. Juan Garza, he's our probation manager, has a caseload as well, and oversees a lot of things on a daily basis in the office and around the county. Wino Dominguez, he is our diversion coordinator, our lead PO, and handles a lot of truancies as well, and a caseload of court kids, which you'll know more about later. Have other staff members. TJ Hunt is unable to be with us tonight due to another engagement he had, but he handles a lot of the rural route, being a county function, so he's in Washtenaw, Lynn, Ritzville, quite a bit, as well as some here in town, in this the panhandle as well. So our office, if you don't know, is on the side of the county services building there. We have a side entrance there. Judge Miller is my supervisor. He is, juvenile court is a branch of Superior Court in the state of Washington. So Judge Miller sends his greetings from Ritzville tonight, knows about it, and was glad you had us here this evening. Basically, we're here to try to make an impact in the lives of youth and families, and to help make this community a better place through basically four areas: probation, diversion, truancy, and community service. We'll go over them a little bit here. You know, we have optimistic viewpoint for youth and families that, you know, that we can make a difference, and that they can make a difference, and they can have a better life, and it makes a better life then in the for the community, the city, and the county as well. Basically, our three things we're involved in is prevention, intervention, and suppression. So prevention is, let's get to them early. Let's help out these kids that are maybe at risk in the grade schools or junior highs. Let's go visit them, see why they're acting up at school. Is there issues at home that we're hearing about? We'll go and help out there. Could be on the streets, could be in the schools, could be, you know, on an athletic field or something. But prevention, because if we can get them a prevention, then we don't have to go to the next step of intervention, which is more labor intensive and more costly. Intervention, we do a lot of counseling and classes and things of that sort as well. A lot of it is put into parameters of probation, the number of points that they need to follow through on. Suppression, you know, we use Martin Hall Detention Facility up in Medical Lake. We average 4 or 5 kids locked up on a daily basis. Then there's also other kids that have been in enough trouble where Martin Hall isn't helping them. They continue to break the law, and we send them to a state. They're sentenced and sent to a state institution where they serve an extended amount of time in a lockup facility. Most of those are on the west side. Basically, starting from the right side, or let's start from the bottom. Truancy, usually younger. There's a law that's been enacted for probably 8, maybe 10 years now. For kids, if they've had 10 unexcused absences, the school districts in our county file a petition with us, which goes then before the judge and the youth as well, saying you better get to school, or you know you're going to have you know, repercussions. There's going to be community service. There's going to be extra classes. And quite frankly, if they're in contempt of the truancy order, they can serve time in detention as well for not going to school. We do put them on community service work crews as well. They don't want to go to school, we'll work them. Diversion is for the minor first-time offenders. Generally younger, but they don't have to be, but they're the lower risk and minor offenders. Probation are kids that have been through the system. The prosecutor's office has filed, they've been arrested, the prosecutor's office has filed the charge, and they've been sentenced to community service, supervision. These guys and TJ, and we have others that help us monitor those kids and their compliance with a number of rules. Parole, those are kids that have been sent to the institution, locked up for a long time, they come back. That is a state function, but they come out on parole, and they're supervised then by state parole officers. This slide shows actually for a little greater, I guess, educational parts, but I'm not going to go through each one of these bubbles or squares with you. But bottom line is, some kid has been arrested, and the police, law enforcement, they write a report. It is sent to the prosecutor's office. It's sent to the juvenile court. After review, then the course of action takes place, and it's usually diversion. It's going to court, which court then the kid and the family, they'll end up in Ritzville before the judge, public defender's appointed, prosecutor's involved in the case, and that's kind of it. And then bottom line is we're supervising the youth then on probation. Again, it's a wordy, kind of printed out for you if you want more in-depth. There'll be no quizzes or tests here this evening on the presentation. They can get up to 12 months of probation if they're going before the judge, up to 150 hours of community service, 30 days of lockup and detention, to a $500 fine, restitution, just determined on the offense. You know, if it's a vehicular prowl or a burglary or something where there's been some money that's needing to be restored back to the victim. And the big square in the middle, juveniles, they have about 15 criteria to meet for probation. School attendance, curfew, drug testing, counseling, electronic home monitoring. We monitor them with an ankle bracelet, keep tabs on them when they're home and when they're at school. Community service work is a huge part of it. Classes set by the court and the probation officers. Aggression replacement training, which is a very successful evidence-based program that we work on. We actually call it the 180 Club, kind of turn things around from being violent to peaceful ways. And then they visit weekly with their probation officer. Probation officer also does school checks, home checks, and you know they've committed a crime. They need to pay the consequences. And from that, then we want them to grow up and be better citizens. Been in this for over 20 years, and honestly, it's been great to see now some kids who are now adults with wives and kids that are, you know, involved in the community and doing a great job. It's just wonderful to see that after a time. It doesn't always happen, but it is great to see. So that's really our heart, to see low recidivism, change lives with these kids. Diversion is our minor offender, and that's a more of a confidential meeting in the office, a contract to sign with the youth, the parents, and then they are on supervision and they have to go by what is lined out in their contract, which is basically a time of probation as well. You've probably heard the term restorative justice. Basically, the mentality is crime commits a wound in a community. How can you heal that wound? Well, in restorative justice, it happens through community service, which we do a lot of, and there's a slide. Restitution, you know, paying back the victims. That's probably one of the most difficult parts of juvenile justice is the restitution, because it is on the youth to pay back that money and not their parents. Legislature passed a law where they have 10 years now to pay restitution. So, you know, that's tough to get the money back to the victims, but we work at that. Victim mediation, where there's actually meetings between the youth, possibly the family, and the victim that has been harmed, and they come together and hash some things out. Pretty powerful thing, actually. Community service is great. We love doing that. We're involved throughout the city and county. The fellow food bank, a lot of time on graffiti removal, road cleanup, housing authority, senior center, Latin senior center, community functions. You know, it's Sand Hill Crane, it's the fairgrounds. All throughout Adams County, we help the elderly work on the Habitat for Humanity homes. So these are kids that are in trouble, and they're giving back to the community in these ways, and it's a good thing. And you know, we have more hard last year. Through the various areas, over 10,000 hours were worked by youth here locally, giving back to the community. Rotary gave us a pressure washer, and we use that on a lot of wood fences. Maybe you've seen them around town, around county, doing some work there, removing graffiti. And sometimes they're removing their own graffiti, which we like. Sometimes they're removing their non-friends' graffiti. Sometimes they have nothing to do with the graffiti. But all we want to do is to try to make Othello a nice place to live, a nice place to look at, and you know, conducive for families and businesses and organizations. So this is just some of the graffiti that's been around town over the past at various places. And you know, we get the phone calls from the OPD or from community members saying, hey, there's graffiti. And we either know about it or we say thank you, and then we get our work crews out there and paint over it or scrub it off or pressure it off. We just got actually some new things. But it does a pretty good job, you know, the before and afters. You know, it just kind of restores a neighborhood or a community. Do some things at night called Night Watch. Gang suppression. We just have a zero tolerance really for youth that want to lean towards gang involvement. Event enforcement. We're asked by the fair. We're asked by the high school to come to events and at nights and see what's going on. You know, be visible out there. Check on kids that are on probation or keep an eye on others that are kind of at risk and heading that way. Being visible out there, along with, you know, at times the city and county law enforcement as well. Spend a lot of time at football games, basketball games, enjoying the game, but keeping an eye on things as well. And the quicker you can get rid of graffiti, the better off everybody is. Our motto is we have more paint and more people than you do. And so local businesses at time donate, or they give us a reduced rate on the paint to paint over it. And we turn the kids and the work crews loose on some of that. Part of probation is room search. We check, do you have anything in your room that you should not have? Is it gang related? Is it something illegal? Go out, curfew checks, community patrols as well. Spend time at the Sun Fair, Relay for Life, have work crews clean up after that. Basketball, football, Fiesta Amistad, the fair, just various events all throughout the year we're involved in. That's the last slide, and that's our staff. TJ is over on the far right. Angie on the left in front, she is graduating soon in criminal justice. She's a intern right now, does tracker transport work. Priscilla Martinez in the middle is a part-time administrative assistant, and Gabby Zamora is our administrative assistant. So that's basically what we do and what we do around the county and in the city, and so we just wanted to kind of come and let you know who we are and what our function is and why we're around. And the bottom line is we like to link up with the community, the schools, the city, the county, the organizations, and try to make this place a great place to live, a great place for businesses, a great place for families and organizations to be here. So anyways, that's it. Didn't know if you had any questions for myself or my staff, but just really wanted to thank you for your time.
Council, questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you strictly under 18 is quote a juvenile?
Great question. If they are adjudicated or have a diversion, if they're arrested at age 17 and we don't get the report till they're 18, then they're in the adult, there has to be a, you know, due process. You have to have a little time to be able to get it. But we do have kids that are 18 or 19 on parole or probation, but they have to be adjudicated at age 17. They can be in juvenile jurisdiction up to age 21. We do have some kids that are sentenced to the state institution all the way to the age of 21.
Now, I've heard in the past that, a quote, there hasn't been room in Martin Hall, and some juveniles that should be there haven't been able to. They've had to wait for an open slot. Is that still happening?
No, there's plenty of room at Martin Hall. Years ago, before Martin Hall was ever in existence, we had very difficult times trying to find a place in Benton Franklin or Grant or Chelan or Spokane County to lock up kids. But Martin Hall has been a great answer for us, and no, we're able to lock up any kid that needs to be locked up.
Immediately?
Immediately.
When they check in for parole, do they do that at county services or over here where the state patrol or parole office is?
That's DOC, which is adult, and ours is juvenile, so they check in. For probation, they check in with us. For parole, they still check in at our office. But a state parole officer from Spokane or Wenatchee will come and meet with them because they monitor the ones that are under state jurisdiction.
If a juvenile doesn't show up for their court date, is a warrant actually issued for them?
Yes, warrants are issued on noncompliance for juveniles, whether they don't show up to court or they've absconded, they've done something else. We generally go out and look for them first and find them. And if we can, and if not, then the warrants are issued.
Any other questions by council? John?
What can we do better to support your efforts in this community?
I guess mainly as a citizen member, you know, law enforcement always says, you know, if we don't know, then what can we do? And we're kind of in the same boat. So especially, you know, if you see kids prowling around, I mean, call law enforcement, you know, and they'll deal with it and they'll pass it on to us. But I think, like I said, the improvements with the parks are huge. It's great, you know, for kids to be active in good events. But I just think, you know, the more we can be good neighbors, the more that we can be active and eyes and ears in our community, you know, the moms and the dads on the porches, per se, you know, that's how I grew up. Moms and dads, you know, kind of took care of the neighborhood, you know, and the more we can do that, you know, the better off our neighborhood's going to be. And if every neighborhood kind of had a similar thing going on, you know, we'd be better off. You know, the more proactive we can be, and you know, we would definitely rather be involved in prevention than suppression. So.
Any more questions from council? Anybody in the audience have a question? Go ahead.
I just want to thank you for the work that you do, and also want to ask, I noticed the volunteer work, is there any volunteer work in association with like pet rescue animals?
I think we've been involved a little bit in the past with some pet rescue, but we're always looking for avenues to turn the youth loose on that are on probation, that need have hours that are court ordered, that they need to complete, and that would be a great outlet for them to complete hours and to help out the pet rescue and take care of whatever needs to be taken care of. So our phone number, I don't know if any of you guys have a card or anything, but call us, we'd be happy to. 488-5646. That'd be a great opportunity for us to help and for the kids to serve and to give back to the community.
I think it's the benefit of the animals and
think you did a good job hiring your staff, because it looks like they can double as bodyguards for you, too.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And honestly, at times, you need it. You know, it can get kind of rough out there at times. And so it's nice to have some big guys around, you know?
Well, thank you, Dave, and the men that work for you and ladies, I should say.
Yes.
We do appreciate all you do in the community and help keep it safe. And thank you very much for educating us.
Great.
That's great.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, Main Street Options, Jay and Mike.
Several meetings we've been discussing the rehabilitation of Main Street, and I think we've come to some conclusions, and Council has asked for a little more information. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to discuss the portion of how do we pay for it. And Mike has put together three different scenarios that show how to fund three different levels of construction that we talked about, and those three different levels being, number one, the total project from West City Limits to 14th Avenue. Second option being the total project minus the turn signals, which would be Broadway 1st, 4th, 7th, and 11th. And then the third option of that, which was the Main Street project phase 3, which was 7th to 14th Avenue, which was one of the first options we talked about. Mike will now take us through the financing portion, and afterwards we're going to be asking for a motion to approve one of these options or a variation of one of these options. And so with that, I'll leave it to Mike.
Thank you, Jay. Good evening, Mayor and Council. I've got a warning here. The information in your packet, I have the different scenarios here. Scenario number one is pardon me? Oh, we still got it on blank, huh? Okay. Scenario number one is the complete project, and it shows the amount of reserves recommended from the various funds, reserve funds, and then the amount that is left over would be the Councilmatic bond. And in your packet, I also showed a debt service schedule, an amortization schedule that showed what that debt service would look like. I don't think I brought that one up, but anyway. Scenario number one is the complete project with the stoplights. Scenario number two is everything is the same, but right at the top, I minus out the traffic signals, which is $1,224,000. So that it reduces the price of the project. It completes Main Street, but it doesn't deal with the traffic lights. And of course, the Councilmember bond amount is considerably less at a little over $2.6 million. And once again, there's a debt service schedule and amortization schedule that shows the difference in the payments, the annual payments. Over the weekend, I got to thinking about this, and I want to present another scenario just for your consideration. And the reason this came to my mind is that there's been discussion about buying property for a new park. And it's one thing to buy the property. It's one thing to buy the property for the park. It was also brought up that once you buy the property for the park, then you have to find ways of improving it. And once again, there's a large cost associated with that. So I want to show you this scenario number four. What I did in scenario number four, right down here, if you can see my, well, I think I'll get the red point.
Right here where the reserves were, I took out the amount that we were going to transfer from the general fund, which was $200,000, and I took out the amount that we would have transferred from the REIT fund, which was $327,000. So that's a total of about $527,000. What that does is it raises the amount of the Councilmatic bond. It's right up, it's not exactly in between, but it's kind of in between the high end that's in your packet and the low end. And I have a debt service schedule, and I'll show that to you as well. The reason for this is that if we do purchase a park and then get excited about developing it, we're going to have to go out for some funding again. And we could take care of that right now, is kind of what this scenario is here. What the debt service schedule looks like this. If you look right, this column right here is the debt service, and if you compare them, here's the large with the signals in it. That's the debt service schedule, it's the incremental increase. I have to make that clear. And then here's the incremental increase on the low end. This is somewhere in between the two. So there's a comparison of that right here. And I just wanted to present that as a consideration for council on the park issue. Anyway, are there any questions that I could answer?
On scenario number two, I'd really like to explore the debt issue, the payback, because I'm not following this net debt service schedule.
Okay,
for the $2.68 million. Do you have that somewhere we can all look at it? Or?
Yeah, I do. I do have it in here. Let's see.
I don't quite understand why there's no principal for 5 years. Is that a general standard on a bond like this?
My understanding with this is because we have current debt service, this thing is structured so that we're only paying interest in the early going along with our current debt service. And when our current debt service is paid off, then we start the principal payments on the new debt.
So it jumps from $134,000 to $219,000 because we paid off the debt service.
That's correct.
That's related mostly to this City Hall building.
That's correct.
So you had them structured this way. So.
Yeah. And I think originally when I presented this, I don't want to misinform council in any way, but if you look at this section right over here, This is the existing debt service, and then this is the net new debt service. So this takes the interest from here. I can move this over to show you what I'm. The heck is going on? Oh, I know why I hit that column. The interest on the new debt service is over here, and I hit this column so I could get everything in here. So you take the interest payment on the new debt and add this to it, and this is the incremental change for 5 years. So this is the interest on the new debt service right here. Okay, so for the first 5 years, the incremental change is greater than when you finally pay off the old debt. The incremental change then goes down. And I don't think I ever pointed that out in the early going. So for the first 5 years, the burden is a little bit heavier than it gets after the old debt is paid off. Just so I make that clear, if you need some clarification on that, that's true of all of these scenarios. In the early going, first 5 years, the debt service is higher.
The combined.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah.
I don't know we necessarily have that on this chart, but it goes from obviously, what the debt service now plus the interest starts at $274,000, reaches a high of $318,000. Then the existing debt service ends, and then it goes down to $219,000 is the actual payment.
Yes. Yes.
So I see. Yeah, that's where you're getting your $78,000.
Yeah, 36 is the incremental difference between what we're currently paying.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, there's a comma.
So make sure I understand, you're saying that 6 years looks like we own the building and its stuff, correct? City Hall? And the other debt service that's associated with that.
That's correct.
That totally drops away. This funding here no longer affects, is not connected to this part of the
that's
city.
Correct. That's correct.
Okay.
Right. In other words, this bond issue does not pay off the old bond issue.
The old debt continues until it's paid off.
Oh, okay. Council questions for Mike?
Mike, could you bring up Olympia Street and make sure we're clear on the funding for Olympia? There's a note on the bottom of scenario one.
Oh, okay, let's see. Right down at the bottom, we had a note. The Olympia Street project is a separate project budgeted in 2010 for $220,000. That is currently in our 2010 budget, and it'll be paid for by a transfer from the utility tax fund. Council could choose to delete the Olympia project and add the $220,000 to the Main Street funding. So it would actually reduce the councilmatic bond by that much. So we thought it was important to put that in.
But if they don't do anything, it's a separate project
right.
by itself, already funded
that's
in
correct.
A separate way.
That's correct.
Doesn't affect the Main Street project.
Right. At this point right now, that's a project that will take place unless a decision comes forth to change that.
But of course, for economics, we'd want to include that in the bid.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes. You said that when you approved it in the budget. That was your comment.
So, Mike, what we're saying here then is this is if the bid comes in at the price that Larry and them put together, correct?
Yes.
So if it's below that, all of this changes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So things start dropping. Okay.
Then there's two things we could do with that. If it came in under the projection, we could continue with the councilmatic bond at the amount that we have already here, and then turn that money into the new park project. Or we could lower the amount of the councilmatic bond. So there would be two options.
Is the REIT money the what we say when people buy property, they put so much into the park fund? Is that what that is, or is that something else?
That's sales tax on real estate sales.
So that's different than the park fund.
Well, yeah, the we have what is called a property fund, a reserve fund, and it's not on here anymore because that is set aside to purchase the park property.
Right.
And I think it's close to about 400,000, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 300,000. I can't remember. It's around $300,000 or $400,000, and we don't touch that in this at all.
Okay.
The REIT monies can be used for parks.
Gotcha.
And so in that scenario that I told you I was looking at over the weekend, this one here. I thought if we could use that for parks and remove it from that, once again, we'd have reserves set aside that we could target for improvements to a new park.
And that way also, plus if it came in at a lower bid, we'd have even additional.
Right. Even additional.
Right.
Scenario four gives you more, you save more, you keep more in your current budget, and you do councilmatic bonds at a higher limit. The previous scenario two,
yeah, two.
The councilmatic bond is lower, but when you use more of your existing fund. And the question came out of the last meeting was, what's our budget going to look like if we do each one of these, or do one of these, what's our budget going to look like? And that's what Mike explained.
Yeah. Any more questions for Mike from the council?
Was there any more feedback on grants or lower, I mean, with these loans, bonds jump up to 5.5% of low interest loans or anything? Or
The time frame hasn't clicked yet. They're still out there.
Okay.
They still may be a part of the package, but the timelines haven't hit yet.
Did scenario four, does that include traffic lights?
No, it does not include traffic lights.
So the only one that includes traffic lights is scenario
number one. Scenario number one.
Okay.
But that's also something we could take into account later if it came in under bid, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
On the cosmetic bonds, do we have to lock in how much we're borrowing before we go to bid?
I talked with Jack McLaughlin about that. When we go out for the bonds, there, and he used a term I had never heard before, but we can make that one of the stipulations, is that when the bids aren't in yet and it isn't settled, we will already be going out into the bond market to get our funding, and then he is going to have a proviso in there that we can change the amount before it's finalized. So that would be a possibility.
I want to make sure, because if we got some other funding all of a sudden,
sure,
that drop what we want. Yeah. So
that was part of my concern, is bonding only what we need. But I do like that ideal that if we did have any excess in the bonds, we could roll it over into the new park.
Yes.
So we could get that project done quicker.
Okay, any other questions for Mike?
I just want to clarify for phase three, the 7th to 14th, without traffic signals, there's no councilmatic bonds involved, or is there?
Originally, no. No, that's all internal funding.
Do I hear a form of a motion by anybody so we can start talking about what you want? Or are we not ready yet?
Well, we got to start somewhere, don't we?
So I'm waiting to see.
It needs to be done. If we do just half of our Main Street, it's going to be quite a while down the road before we get started on the second half. And like I said last week, if we're going to wait around for state funding, I think it's going to be a long time before we see anything. And we have an option here to do it completely funding without going to the public and asking more money from them. And I'm all for just doing the whole project right now.
Plus, I think it'll save us some money in the long run.
Okay, so you're saying one, two, what type of form of motion are you doing? Four?
One.
One? Street lights also?
Yes.
Is there a second?
Oh, second.
Second that.
Okay. Who wants it? John? You want it then? Okay, John second. Okay. Any more discussion?
Yes, I think it's outrageous for you to indebt the city those kind of numbers. I think it's a poor decision by the council. I think it's short-sighted. I think what we pay in interest will 10 times more than offset what we save by doing the whole project at once. So I'm very much against that.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Any other council questions, comments?
I would like to say that I think it's a really positive direction for the city to really work on getting Main Street just done. It's one of those things that once it is completed, it'll be more of a, it'll bring people that come to this community, it'll make them want to come here. It'll also maybe help with businesses that do see this place as a place to relocate to. Getting it and just getting the road itself and new traffic lights is a huge step in doing that.
Can you restate the motion again? I didn't hear everything that you said, Ken.
Make the motion that for option number one, doing the whole project with the street lights.
Was there, when we talked about this before, we talked about taking out the street lights? Now, there was some discussion there about putting in conduits and that sort of thing so you didn't have to dug up the street later.
That would be scenario number two.
That's scenario number two.
Yeah, but that's the kind of thing is already in there, so you save digging up your streets later, and it makes it easier to do it in scenario two.
But don't we currently have a problem with our streetlights now being out of compliance? But
what's the problem with the streetlights?
You want, Larry? You want to go over that? The issue of the length of the arms and the liabilities. The old bull, young bull thing.
One thing to consider also in regards to scenario one, we could make the traffic signals a separate schedule that's optional with the owner just to see where the pricing comes in. Traffic signals are a different critter, if you will. They're different than road or utility work because there's a lot of specialty items that go into making those controllers, getting the controllers to work, and getting the signals to synchronize with themselves. We can make that optional with owners so that if the prices do come in exorbitant, we don't have to do them at this time. A council decision at the time of award, so you have one more look at it. If the pricing does come in as phenomenal as the rest of the bidding climate, then might be more palatable. Another thing to consider.
Even under option number two, that could work. If it comes in and then we could add one or two, they would be a schedule that could be added as a bonus.
That's kind of my feeling too, is that I think we ought to still leave that as an option, even if we went with number one, but still leave that in the bidding process to leave that as an option for those traffic signals to see where they come in at. Weigh that situation at that time.
Yes, I'd kind of like to go with option number two, and then if the bids come in under, you could have them.
Well, we have a form right now on the floor, so that's for option number one, so it does make me a little nervous.
Yeah, the traffic lights could be part of the bidding process, though, for the whole scenario. Anyway, what the problem with our current lights?
The problems with your current lights is that when you travel up Main Street, you notice that on 1st and 4th and 7th and Broadway, that the signal arms, there's two lights on them, but they only cover one lane. So the new current standard, if you were to update your lights, is that it needs to cover both travel lanes and your turning lane, which you have all three of them. You have three lanes, basically, per side when you're driving on Main Street. Have two travel lanes and a turning lane. So your current signal system tells people to go, basically, but it doesn't tell people when they can turn. The signal at 14th does. The signal at 11th, the signal arm is actually long enough to handle that, and so on that particular street, we would just be adding new updated heads, a new controller that can handle the turning movements. I'm not a signal expert. We have a specific guy in our office that's all he does is deal with traffic signals. And should the council decide that they want to proceed with the traffic signals or even the traffic signals as an option, he will be out here studying your traffic signals and come up with the best plan that works for your town.
Okay.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
As we're considering possibly doing that whole street from our west city limits to 14th, that section in there on Broadway, which we already went through that that intersection when we did Broadway itself. If we have to add anything to that, we should at least favor that north side so we don't cut into that, what we've already done here in the last few years. So you might make a note of that so we're not going in there and tearing up a section of street that we've already done it in a short period of time. So I don't know whether you've taken that in consideration or not, if you're just going to go in and clean that old street and start over, or what you had in mind there. But a lot of that groundwork was already done in that particular intersection when we did that portion of it.
Was that during that project, the utilities underneath of Broadway and Main Street were updated and extended out of the paved portions? So it would be just up to the new asphalt cutting and tie what are necessary. The only thing that we would have to cut through there would possibly be storm sewer.
We could favor that north side, so then when we did Broadway coming down, we could clean that up from that direction.
Correct, but we won't like that intersection now. Okay. But we will dig through a portion of it.
Yes. Just keep that in mind when you do the next section here.
Okay, the form of the motion has been changed a little, so Ken, since you're the start on this. So the form of the motion is to do number one with the lights. How did you put that, Larry? Okay, so you agree with that?
I'm agreeable.
That's fine with you, John?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so do I hear, okay, all in favor of that? Say aye. Oh, wait, raise your hands, I'm not going to know. Raise your hands, I'm not going to be able to tell. Three people? Okay. All opposed, raise your hands. Four, okay, that went down. So do I hear a different motion? Or do you want to wait and think about it?
I am all in favor of doing the whole project and saving the taxpayers some money, I think, in the long run. However, I'm more in favor, I think, of scenario number four, where we're going to keep some of those reserves so that if we do get a new park, we could do that.
So are you going to make a motion?
You know, that's my hope. Hope on this, that this project will actually come in closer to 5.5 is what I'm hoping for. And that would give us a lot of extra.
Yeah, and I think, would it be possible to also, like we talked about, with the signals for scenario four also?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mike, can you put four back up there?
I'm sorry.
Can you put four back up on the screen?
Scenario number four. Once again, the total project. Now, this is just the street portion up here. The water portion is down below. So here's the 5.232 million, and then the Councilmatic bond is just a little over 3.1 million. There are no general fund reserves. I pulled that back out. That was 200,000. I left in the street fund reserves, and I pulled out the REIT reserves of 327,000. And then there are some reserves from utility taxes of 592,000. And then the street portion is funded through water reserves and then an interfund loan from the sewer fund to the water fund. That would be approximately a four-year loan at 4%, and I believe that would be about almost 136,000 per year payback from the water fund.
So the difference between this one and scenario number two is you're taking out
$200,000 from the general fund and out of the REIT funds and adding it to council manning funds.
Yes, right, right. In other words, that increases the council manning bond by $527,000. That's correct.
And left the general fund and the real estate excise tax fund in the budget. We didn't move it to the council manning fund.
Right.
We left it in the budget. So the budget remained fuller and the council manning bond increased.
Right.
And this one here includes no streetlights.
That's correct. The street lights are taken out of this scenario.
But if things came in low enough, we could add those back in? Is that correct?
Yes, it can be done like we do on the other one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does that include Olympia Street?
Olympia Street is not a part of
it.
That is not.
That's going to be separate.
That's correct. That's all taken care of.
Eamon, we talked about, there was a mention in the office of the reserves being a percentage of the budget fund, and you said there was some kind of recommendation for that, and where do we stand with that?
Normally, the cities run 15-18% reserve. That's a healthy reserve, and we exceed that. Mike had those numbers the other day. I can't remember how far, but we exceed that a lot.
Yeah.
Basically, the council's financial policy established reserves at the minimum level of healthy cities, and we're way above those, like the $500,000 in the general fund.
I think with our budgeted ending fund balance for this year was about a little over $1.2 million, and our total budget for the general fund is around $4.5 million. So that is over 20%. It's 21-22%. And we haven't brought that to council yet. Right now, council requires an amount and not a percentage. And the amount for the general fund is $500,000. That could be a little out of your comfort zone. It's a little out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things that I'm working on that I want to bring to council, is to reconsider that and make it a percentage instead of a fixed amount. Because as our budget changes, then that would change with it and be more practical.
I'd be a little more comfortable with 20% than 15.
Yes.
In this day and age. But I tend to agree with Gina.
So if we get, if we pass this and got it funded, we can still get a grant, even though we've already funded this project. We can still apply for it and get it to supplement this.
In fact, there's one coming up that we have our eyes on specifically through the Regional Transportation Organization, QuadCo, that the city in Adams County is a member of. It's the next funding phase of the economic stimulus monies, ARRA phase two. There's a lot of questions as far as what it is, where it is, when it's going to come out. No one really knows right now, but when it does come out, it's going to be very quick. The questions that they're going to ask you are you ready? Are you shovel ready? Do you have your design complete? Is your environmental reporting done? And by doing this, we'll have the environmental reporting done. In fact, it's done right now. And we'll have the design ready so that we can say, yes, our project is ready to go. And we get extra points for that.
And just to clarify again, with this scenario, if we do the council medic bonds the way they are, and we come in under bid, and we get grants, we can include the traffic lights and or roll some of that money over into the park scenario.
Just like maybe I'll clarify this, if options 1, 3, 4, options 1, 3, and 4 can all include the traffic signals as an alternate. I think it's option 2 that only is, no, it's option 3, I'm sorry. Yeah, option 3 is the only one that's 7-14. All of these options
mentioned the Clotco Board. Jay is our representative on that board, and they meet in Grant County. And they're the regional liaison with the State Transportation Improvement Board. And if we are ready, we stand a very good chance of being funded through that board. And that's where the money will come down through. And as Larry said, it will be a very quick thing. And if you're not ready, you won't get funded.
We'll be in competition with all the other cities in the state that are part of regional or municipal transportation planning organizations. Taylor just went to a meeting a couple weeks ago down in Yakima, where the Yakima Transportation Organization was looking at exactly the same thing. And cities in the valley are scrambling to come up with a project that will be ready to go as quick as we think the turnaround is going to be. And a lot of the communities aren't going to be able to because they haven't done any of the planning like a fellow has already. We're also, Dan, are going to a meeting in about a week and a half that the State Department of Commerce is sponsoring over in Lynn, looking at projects specifically in Adams County that have an economic development aspect to them, which Main Street does qualify for, as well the primarily commercial businesses on the street. So it's a win-win. We'll be looking at any aspect that develops.
Are you looking for the industrial area on Highway 24 south of town? Are you throwing that one in at all these grants too?
Yes. It won't be eligible for the Quadco because they typically look at arterials, which Main Street qualifies for, but the roads down there don't. But the Economic Development Conference that we're going to next week definitely does, and we'll be putting that in as well.
So if we made a decision on a plan tonight, what kind of a timeline are we looking at?
We would anticipate being out in construction by the first part of June. We were fortunate to get funding through the county to start the design process. We have all the survey work completed and the base mapping done so that we can go immediately into detailed design and have that done depending upon, of course, which scenario we choose. But even with the scenario that includes the traffic signals, we should have those done. So we're out of construction around the first part of June.
The answer to the finance question of how long will that take, we talked about some months, about 90 days, I think we talked about before. Mike's done some research with a firm. I think you came up with 30 days. Is that the answer?
Well, yeah,
financing can be done in 30 days.
It typically takes them on an average 60 days, but if council made a decision tonight, tomorrow they will start, they will feed me some stuff that I have to start working on to get them information. And the sooner I get that to them, he said they could be closing the bond issue in 30 days. And that would be working very, very hard at getting that done. But that is a possibility.
So say if we got one of these grants, and just to throw a figure out, say it was $1 million, can you pay off councilman bonds on that? Or would you just have to take it out of some of this other, like utility taxes, we're taking 592 out of that? Would you have to put it towards that? You know, put that back in your budget, or how would that work?
Bond issues are have a lot of covenants when they're issued, and some of them have provisions that you can't do an early payoff. It might be down through the issue a few years that you can pay something off early, but usually in the very beginning, they don't have provisions, or they do have provisions where you can't do that. People buy bonds to make money, you know, they're investing their money, and I don't believe that scenario would work out. If we knew before we closed on the bond issue, then Jack is going to have a proviso in that says we can lower the amount that we're going to require from the bond issue. But the two would have to come together for us to do that. If we'd already If we already close on the bond issue, then it's definitely a bond issue.
But that's what we would work on the staff with our engineers is to make that timing work.
Yeah, I don't see the urgency on the bond issue. You don't need the money to June 1st. I'd wait till May 1st to decide on the amount.
Yes.
I guess we get any grants between now and then.
Yeah, I agree. There wouldn't be any need to hurry that through. I think initially we were concerned that we had to have the money locked in to get the bids. But I think we found out that we don't have to do that. I think it's evident where the city's going and what they're capable of doing, and I think that in the bid process that we can let the bidders know exactly where we stand on that.
Another possibility would be to make the traffic signals that grant application by itself. So it's not tied specifically to the road, but the funding agencies could see the amount of investment the city is making as a match against the traffic signals and see that the city's putting in much more than what they would normally encounter for an actual search into the city look better.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that same thing. It's a possibility with that option that we could add that as far as there's a grant to go. I'm thinking the same way in there, Ray.
And there's another option also is the old bond, too. If we ended up with a bunch of surplus money, we might be able to pay off the old bond maybe or something like that, right? Because that's not tied to this new one.
That's true.
Because we're at the end of it, so there may not be really much of a...
So that one could be payoff
money? Pardon?
It might be.
Because it'd be paying his bond to...
Just the principal.
Yeah.
Well, I believe it can. I'd have to look at... we'd have to look into the bond covenants to see if that's a possibility.
Okay. So do I hear a form of another motion?
I'd like to make a motion to go with scenario number 4.
Okay.
Maybe it keeps our reserves intact for that future park, and we could also add those traffic signals in if we can either come in under bid or get the grants.
Is there a second?
I would second that.
Mark? Okay, second. Any more discussion?
I think it's too much debt load for this town.
Thank you, Mark.
Are we in question?
What's that?
Questions.
So I just have any questions?
Mark mentioned the debt load. What is our current Councilmatic bond capacity, or what is our maximum amount?
The capacity for Councilmatic is just a little over $5.5 million.
And so scenario 4 would be using 3.1
almost 3.3. We would still have almost 2.5 million capacity left.
Yeah, if the job was bid at engineer's estimates.
Mm-hmm. And this bond ties us up for 25 years.
Yes. Because it's interest only for the first 5, and then, yes.
But I don't see any other way to pay for the street either. To get done. And it's been neglected. It's going to get really bad on us. It's going to cost us more in the long run. And we're going to have to, we'll be back here again, figure out how to still do it.
Okay, Mike, why don't you, just for everybody to understand, where the money is coming from the Councilmatic bond as far as it's not a tax upon the people?
Oh.
It's coming out of our budget?
Yeah, there is a definite difference between a Councilmatic bond and what we call a special levy or a voted bond issue. A voted bond issue raises the rates, the property tax rate. It is called a special levy. So you have your regular general levy and then you have a special levy, and the special levy is the difference. And that's a voted issue. A councilmatic issue comes out of our general operating expenses. There is no increase to the general public. We simply make it work out of our operating revenues.
Great, thank you.
See, I understand that part of it, but my point is when we pay $230,000 a year to pay this bond off, which a large percent of it is interest, that's opportunity lost on spending that on something else. And that's why when we gave 5% administrative increases on salary, I said we don't have money. And now we have to go out and get higher percent of councilmatic bonds because we don't have those in reserves. That's big picture. I don't get hung up on all these account things where you can slide money around, but big picture, we don't have excess money, and I said that before. And now we have to borrow money because we don't.
I got one thing.
Okay, Ken.
Yeah, I've been kicking this thing around myself a little bit, and I know you don't like to borrow money. I know you want to finish projects, so you got two ways to look at it. Don't do anything. Sit there, let the street decay till it costs you twice as much money to do it, till inflation goes up, price goes up, till all the contractors are busy, price goes up again. So you got a hard choice to make between a rock and a hard spot. But I still think that if you look at the situation, go back in here and build that street, do it now, you're going to save a lot of that interest money. If it costs you 5% or 5.5% for that money to do it, you're going to save that much in inflation rates. You're going to save maybe not totally that amount of money, but you're going to save probably 2.5% to 3%. On top of that, you can change the price of the construction will run another 2% higher than that, or maybe 10% higher. It's hard to tell what will happen. Once things get in process, start moving again, construction rates are going to go up. It's just the way things go. So I think that you're just going to have to bite the bullet and go ahead and do this. I know we don't like to borrow money and make something happen, but we can't sit here and not do nothing either. My other suggestion is that when we put this out to bid, is still put that option in there for that traffic signals, and then we can play with that a little bit. So that's my comment for today.
Okay, thank you, Ken. Any more questions or anything? Okay. All in favor for, what was the motion again? It's been a while. Scenario number four, with the traffic lights set aside as a separate. Okay. Yeah, okay. Raise your hand so I know. Who's in favor of that? Opposed? The same? Okay, thank you, Mark. You're duly noted. Okay, that passes then. Okay. Pet Rescue Annual Report, Daryl.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. Good evening. For the record, Daryl Piercy, City Planner. I have an issue before you that will be a little easier to digest, I think, than your last topic of conversation. You have a contract, the city has a contract with Pet Rescue to provide animal services at the city shelter. There's a requirement in that contract that Pet Rescue provide a yearly report to the council on their activities and their issues pertaining to the operation of that city shelter. So we have representatives here this evening from Pet Rescue, and they would like to make a presentation to the council.
I'm Ken Simmons from Pet Rescue. First, maybe what I need to do is just run through what our adoption and number of animals that went through the town. This year, we had a total of 222 dogs come through the city pound. We adopted 65 of those out, 15 went to Grant County, and the 15 that go to Grant County generally are pit bulls, which we can't adopt out. We transferred 10 to other shelters. Generally, those are special dogs. Maybe they're Australian Shepherds or something that there's special rescues out there that have a better chance of adopting those dogs out. We have 5 missing, and by that, we have occasionally people who come down there and who will steal the dogs out of the shelter. Not the inside, but they steal them from the outside. They climb over the fences, or they cut the fences, or they get in there and they just steal. Generally, it's probably their dog that they're stealing back, just saving some fees. Owner claimed there was 115 dogs that were claimed by the owners, which is, to me, a tremendous amount. So there's a lot of people in Othello that are pet lovers and who are taking care of their animals they pay the fees, get the animals out, and I think they have to buy dog tags when they get the animals out of there. We don't really have any issues as far as with the city. We are generally doing some maintenance and cleanup down there, which we did a couple weeks ago, and we had some issues, I guess, with maybe not getting permission to do those. There was a little bit of a misunderstanding on probably our part and the city's. What we did was we put some wood chips down in the kennels, which basically were just replacing the wood chips that were there that had been slowly, settled into the dirt and the mud and everything else. The purpose of the wood chips is just to keep everything clean, because as you know, this winter it's been really wet and we've had a lot of mud down there, so the animals get muddy, we get muddy, and it's just something we try to do to keep from slipping and falling down and keep the animals cleaner too. The other thing we did was we put in a couple of temporary pens, which the main reason, as probably most of you know, is our shelter burned down down at Curtis Drive. We're working on getting funds. We're working on designs, plans. We have to get a lot of things approved before we can start on that shelter. We hope to have that shelter going probably mid-summer, but the temporary pens we put down there were partly to house the animals when we're putting the wood chips down there, when we're cleaning things up. It just gives us a little bit more room. We probably have stretched maybe the rules as far as how long animals can be there because we don't have any place else to go. Normally, when the animals are there for probably, I think it's 6 days, we would take them down to our shelter. We don't have that option now. We have foster homes we go to, which does take some of the strain off, but the Curtis Drive shelter really took the majority of animals down there. It gave us time to work with them, get them spayed and neutered, and just find the proper homes for them. The majority of animals that we do adopt go out of the area, because we do have a lot of an influx of people here in the spring and summer. When they leave in the fall, they just leave the animals here. So what we try to do is prevent them from producing more animals. Everything that we adopt out is spayed or neutered. So I guess are there questions about the improvements that we made? They were unauthorized, but we were trying to make some improvements that we needed to do. And maybe we just didn't go about the right procedure, but we hope to solve that tonight. So, I guess there's a couple other questions. As far as the wood chips around the building, there was some concern that we covered up gravel. There was no gravel where we put the wood chips around the building. That was mud also. And there was some ditches or some piles of dirt there from when the electrical was put in underground to go out to the kennels. And that was all leveled up and cleaned up, and then we put the wood chips around that. And I don't know if anybody's been by there to look at it, but it is very nice to look at now compared to what it was. We have some pictures that, you know, if anybody wants to see the pictures, I can show you some pictures of what the animal pound looks like now. But to me, it's a tremendous improvement over what it was. The biggest thing, I guess, is we would like to take care of the unauthorized improvements and make sure that that's okay with the city council. That's what we're here for.
Any questions for Ken from the council?
I'm hearing that some pets are staying in your kennels from 6 months up to a year.
No, not even close. I don't know if I don't have any literature or records as far as so I can document that, but the majority of the animals we adopt out are probably maybe 90 to 120 days maximum. Now, there may be one or two that have stayed for a while. Generally, if we have one that we can't adopt out, if we can't find another rescue to take it, usually one of us adopts it. That happens quite regularly. But I would have to do some record checking to see if there's anything that's been there 6 months to a year. I personally can't tell you that there was. But I'd be glad to look at that and bring it to light if there is, you know, something that's been there that long. I just can't believe it, that there is.
And I understand the awkward situation for a no-kill shelter. If you can't adopt out, what do you do? But from a council view and even from a citizen that donates, not necessarily myself, but representing those, it didn't seem the intent to keep an animal, you know, for a year under the adoption status. You know, we need to use the resources toward continuing the momentum.
I could do some research on that and just see, you know, what maybe the longest terms that we've had some animals, but generally it's 90 to 120 days. Okay. And we have to, first off, when we get the animals, they get their shots. We kind of evaluate them. We get them all spayed and neutered and make sure they're healthy. And once that process is done, then we start the process of adopting and putting them on the internet, on the internet to see if we can find homes. And if we have an animal that we have problems adopting, there's generally a rescue out there that for special animals, and a lot of times they will go to that rescue. So we've actually brought in a couple animals to our rescue unit that, say, another rescue unit has had that couldn't find a home for it either, and hopes that we could find a home for it here. So we do some of that also. But that doesn't involve the city at all. That's strictly us as a pet rescue outfit.
Right. Well, and to involving the city, I think you summarized it pretty well where we're at. Is what you people do is excellent, and we can't thank you enough. However, it appears in the letters we got that some lines were crossed and actions were taken without the proper approval. So now, we're there. Now what do we do?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yep.
Any other questions from council?
How many animals are you planning for down on Curtis Drive? How many will you handle there?
That we're still not quite settled on, but we will, once we get all our plans and everything together. Biggest thing we've been doing is raising funds and then trying to figure out what all we have to do to, because we don't own that property down there. It's leased. There's some conversation going on with the owner as far as what terms we can get on a lease. And then there was some concern about insurance, septic tank systems, different concerns that we're trying to get all that settled. We hope to have something as big or bigger than was there already. And we had, I believe, six pens, plus we had a puppy pen, plus we had some general outside pens down there. It'll be a lot bigger than that. That was a temporary stop gap when we went in there. That facility had been built probably 25 years ago, I believe. What we're doing is we have to, just like the city, when you do some major work, you have to bring everything up to code, and that's the process we're in right now, is trying to make sure when we build the facility, we have a proper facility there. So.
And how many dogs do you have down here now?
When I was there Sunday, we had 11 full-size dogs and two puppies. And I understand today I'm not sure, absorption or whatever, we got three more puppies today.
Could I see the pictures, please?
Sure.
So in your words, what happened down there? Did you just add outdoor kennels, literally a four?
These are strictly portable kennels. It's actually two portable kennels. They're wired onto the existing fence, and we can remove them in about an hour. If they need to be removed, we can remove them. That's the gist.
So are these runs more the permanent ones?
Okay.
With the...
You can just barely... This is the temporary one right here. There's two temporary ones. They're about 8 by 12.
Right.
And those are just... They're not permanent in any way. They're just wired onto...
But these are permanent?
These are all permanent, yes. Okay. And that is the city built those for us probably, 4 years ago. Those, I just want to stress, those are just temporary kennels that we put up mainly when we were actually working on this other work down there, we needed to, because we had to move the animals out of the pens, hold them until we got all of the wood chips in there, and then move the houses and all of the pens and everything back in there.
Now these are the temporary ones up here.
Yeah, these are the temporary. And those, like I said, those are only about 8 by 12.
And these are the...
Those are all permanent. And we have somebody down there every day. If anybody wants to come down and see the operation and see what we do, you're welcome to come down there, because we've been doing this for, I believe this is going on 4 years now. We've had a contract with the city to do this.
Are you still using the brick building, or is it
done? Yes. When Doyle picks up an animal, it goes into the brick building for 3 days, then it's released to us, and I believe we have to hold it for 3 more days, because we've run into people where they haven't even known their dogs are missing,
right,
for probably a week or two. Then some of them will come down there in like 4 to 6 weeks and say, oh, that's my dog. And well, it's obviously been released to us, it's been spayed, neutered, shots, and they just think we need to just give it back to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we had somebody come in the other day, their dog had been gone 6 weeks, and they finally realized that it was in the city pound. But all this is just, the number of animals in there right now is just temporary, because we don't have our Curtis Drive facility. Once that's up and running again, the dogs will be there probably a week to 2 weeks tops in the city pound. Then they'll go to our shelter.
So as our agenda says, pet rescue request, is your request just to have those two portable kennels there?
Our request is just if we can keep those temporarily there. If it's a problem, we'll remove them. But because we have no facility currently, we hope to be able to just use them temporarily. The biggest problem is we still have people come down there. They tie dogs to the pound. They leave them in boxes. And so we never know what to expect when we go down there. We don't know if these animals are healthy, sick, so, and a lot of times it's on a weekend, so we don't have a chance to get them to a vet. So it's kind of nice to have a quarantine place where we can put them until we can get them down there. Normally, the inside of the pound, the brick building, is where anything that Doyle picks up goes, mm-hmm. and it stays in there. So,
giving the owner a chance to retrieve their dog to the city,
right,
channels.
Yes,
so.
Exactly.
Can you go back to the mic so that we can be recording?
So
thanks,
though. So.
I should have turned,
yeah,
this one around.
Right here?
Right.
Okay.
And those are, they're just wired onto the existing pets.
So more questions? I see you, Ken.
Got one. What are we talking time-wise as far as how many months you're talking about temporary? I mean,
we're hoping to have our facility up and running this summer sometime.
So on the motion, we have a amount of months on it. So what are you guys wanting on the motion?
What do you want, 8 months, something like that?
Well, like anything, we've had a lot of people offer to help us. We've had a pretty good fundraising. The biggest thing is getting our plan finalized, approved, because we are in the city limits. We have to have everything approved and to start construction. It's not going to be a tremendously complicated building. It's just going to be basically a shell with kennels, a restroom, and water in it. And so once construction starts, it's probably going to be maybe a couple of months at the most. So
we're waiting for...
We're probably waiting for maybe another month to 2 months tops before we can start construction.
So you want 8 months?
We can always be out of there sooner than that, but it'd be probably handy to have it a little extra time just in case.
So we want 8 months. That'll take us to what, September?
September would be fine. So
8 months? Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of my thought. You know, at least that'll give you time.
Give us a little
winter here, and
yeah,
it gives you the summer months. And
the one thing we're probably that's not helping us is the current economy. I think we've had more dogs dropped off this year than we've ever had down there. People just can't afford to feed them, so they think, well, we'll take care of them. So they just drop them off or tie them to the fence and leave them, you know, figure that we'll find a better home for them. And we're a nonprofit thing, so we operate on whatever money we can get a hold of.
Yeah.
I do.
Can I make a comment before motion to make sure we're headed in the right direction? First of all, this is a contract issue. So we need to make a motion, if that's what you're inclined to do, relative to the contract. First of all, Pet Rescue is doing a tremendous job, and we have a very solid rapport with them. We appreciate everything you do, and I know Doyle is really proud. And
we work with the city, and the city works with us, and so it's been a very good benefit to both of us.
It benefits everybody.
Yes.
The two issues in the contract are, that number one, the number of dogs, which is 20, as outlined by the contract. The numbers that Ken identified are well within that. So if you want to leave that alone, fine. If you want to increase that, fine. The other issue is the improvements that they made to the pound itself, which should have been authorized by the city, and that's the other reason they're here, is for you to say yes to the improvements or no to the improvements. If you do say yes to them, as was brought out, we would ask that you put a time limit on it so it doesn't become the norm. It's the exception, but it has to go back to what the contract says. The other consideration that we talked about with staff is the property that they lease from the ex-owner of Ladd Irrigation. There's a lot of room there, and if they could put the portable kennels, attach them to our fence, could they attach them to their fence on Curtis Drive? And as a consideration, we kicked this around with staff meeting, in fact, two staff meetings, that maybe they could just put the portable pins out there where they had the fire. If you don't like that, then approve a motion to let them make the improvements at our pound. But you need to do that relative to the contract. So number of dogs and approval of the improvements with a timer.
The other thing is, just to kind of clarify too, is when we start construction down at Curtis Drive, that's kind of a long, narrow lot, and there isn't a lot of room in there. And so we would prefer to be able to leave those here, but if we have to move them, we can do it. It's just once we start construction, there's going to be a lot of traffic in and out of there, and it would just simplify things a lot if we could leave them here until, say, September.
So the number of dogs, 20, is adequate?
That's not a problem. I don't know if we've ever been to 20.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions by council? So we got the time of 8 months, which would be September. Anything else, Eamon, you wanted?
Nope, just to approve
the changes.
Approve the improvements that you've been shown by picture, and extend the period of time for use of that until September, and we will draft an amendment for Pet Rescue and the mayor to sign, if that's what you want.
Okay, so do I hear a motion from the council to move to approve the request from Pet Rescue to modify the existing contract to allow for additional pets to be temporarily housed for a period not to exceed 8 months? Is that going to cover everything?
And the dog limit's still okay.
The dog limit's fine, yeah.
Okay.
I so move.
Okay, is there a second? Second? Dan?
Yeah.
Okay. Any more discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, thank you. We're going to take a 2-minute break for those that need to use the restroom.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate what you guys are doing. Thanks, Ken.